The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm a huge Keith Nix fan, and I kind of want to tell some stories about Keith right back at him. I'm grateful for him for a whole bunch of reasons, but one of them is he said that I'm really good at being other-centric. Did you hear that, honey? One of the downsides of my job, and there's all sorts of blessings getting to represent the people in Nebraska and go big red to the 14 of you over here, winningest college football team of the last 50 years, in case you don't know that here in SEC country. We were really great from 50 years ago till about 17 years, and we've had a little bit of a couple years of a dark spell, but we'll be back. Keith said something, one of the downsides is I'm away four nights a week, and that's terrible. And my wife isn't usually with me, but she wasn't going to miss this because we want to do the expo tomorrow morning. We're classical / homeschooling / hybridized dual geography, sort of weird cobble it together parents. And we've been trying to come to this for 2 or 3 years. So I'm grateful for the chance to speak, but we're really just here to survey all the wares and the new curricula out there. But Keith said really generous things that aren't true, but I'm really glad she got to hear it. Want to tell you something else about Keith, though. If you, David, could keep him quiet, it would be helpful. I was speaking at an event about 6 weeks ago, and Keith was there. And because Keith and I are friends, and he's heard me speak enough times, you know this story? Because he's heard me speak enough times, we were in a backyard venue, and these different school folks had gotten together, and they were wanting to recruit other people into the classical Christian and hybrid schooling movement. And Keith didn't think there was any reason he needed to pay attention. And so he went off to the deck of the house just to sort of get a little bit of distance and put his feet up. And he managed to put his feet up far enough that it changed the sort of leverage point on his butt on the chair, and he collapsed the whole chair. The chair just exploded in every direction. And at that point, we were having a really scintillating talk, and after that, we could never get anybody back to the main point. So, Keith, if you please could not disturb everybody today, we would appreciate that. I want to do too much. We have an hour and change, a couple minutes more maybe, together, and we're going to spend a decent chunk of that in question and answer, and I want to do too much. So I want to make a classical Christian school, classical education trivium nerd joke as my excuse for violating rules about not speaking too quickly. I don't intend to do rhetoric today. I'm only doing grammar and logic. So I got a whole bunch of things I want to cover and I want us to have in common. I want to try my hand at a synthesis of a whole bunch of things that are happening in our time and place. And I'm not going to try to do it rhetorically well because there's too much material, so I want to speed through it. I want to tee up a bunch of different topics for our question and answer time together. I will say, though, I was given a speech to a travel industry executives a couple of weeks ago. And I was also kind of doing a lightning round of the speech. And the CEO of a big hotel chain in America was sitting right where you are in the front row, like seat 4. And the entire time I'm speaking, he's playing with his phone. And I'm thinking, this is so rude. Like, I think I'm sometimes boring, but I'm not that boring today. And I've only been going for like 11 or 12 minutes, and you haven't looked up yet. Why are you paying no attention to me? And I thought he was cleaning out his email. It turned out he was just trying to record the thing, and he didn't know how to do it, and he was using the wrong app. And so I kept noticing this guy on his phone, and I was trying to not be distracted by it, and all of a sudden his phone shouts, "I haven't understood a word you've said." It was Siri. He had honestly, instead of recording it in something that would record a long-form thing, it was trying to translate everything I had said in one 11-minute run-on sentence as a query of Siri. Anyway. At that point, I didn't feel so bad he wasn't paying attention to me anymore. He was like somebody's great-grandma who had a new iPhone that day. I'm PCA, but I'm going to pretend I'm a Baptist topical preacher for a minute. I'm going to give you my outline. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. Then I'm going to tell you. Then I'm going to tell you what I told you. So I want to cover 4 things. First, we live in an incredibly disruptive moment. both economically and culturally. And I'm an intellectual historian or intellectual cultural historian by background, so don't think there's a closet Marxist in front of you that's going to find an economic variable for everything. But I do think most of what's going crazy in our culture is downstream from the economic disruption, which is that we're living through a digital revolution. Very few people live through really big, discontinuous times in their life. And people always think they live at an inflection point in human history. Words like unique, exceptional, things that have supposedly never happened before. Usually it's the historian's job to pop that balloon for people. Historians' job are basically to be boring and spoil sports at dinner parties. And so somebody will say, can you believe this? This has never happened before in human history. We live at this inflection point. And usually the historian's job is to say, actually, lots and lots of continuity in this moment. You think this moment is unique because you're here and you're a narcissist. But actually, lots of continuity. I'm going to go against type as a boring historian here and say I actually think we live at a shockingly disruptive moment in human history. The transition from the kind of third stage of economic history, industrialism, to the fourth stage, whatever we call it, a lot of times sociologists and historians and economists are just calling it the post-industrial moment because we don't really know what to call this mobile, rootless, wired, digital, new semi-nomadic age that we're living. What's unique about our moment, what's different than really big epical transitions from hunter-gatherers to agrarians from thousands and thousands of years ago in Mesopotamia until 150 years ago in the broad application of urbanization, industrialization, mass immigration, and the rise of cities. So from thousands and thousands of years ago to 150 years ago when you went from hunter-gatherer to agrarian and then from agrarian to industrialist, all three of those ages still had lifelong work. In fact, hunter-gatherers and agrarians didn't even have job choice. You just had becoming 8 or 10 or 12 or 14 and doing more of what mom and dad and grandma and grandpa had always done. Industrialization creates a massive change. First of all, it changes the curve of output for the globe. Per capita consumption opportunities change radically from 200 to 120 years ago. But you have this one disruptive moment around adolescence where you choose a specialized job. You're not just hunter-gatherer chasing the buffalo like mom and dad, grandma and grandpa forever before, or agrarians like mom and dad, grandma and grandpa forever before. You now have a specialized job choice. It creates this whole category of angst and identity crisis around adolescence. But when you leave home, when you finish high school or drop out of high school and get your first job, or if you're one of the very small number of people who went to higher education, when you finish, basically everybody got one job and they kept it till death or retirement. So even though industrialization, that third period of economic history, was different than the prior two because there was job choice, there was only job choice once. What's happening to us is we're going to have job choice forevermore. There's no lifelong work ever again. The economy built on the digital revolution, built on human innovation, entrepreneurship, and creativity is going to constantly gobble up and disintermediate any work that we have such that not just your firm, not just your industry, but your whole skill set is going to become obsolete multiple times over the course of your life. It's really scary. And even though we aren't good at talking about it together, I think the vast majority of the disruptive stuff that's happening in our culture is downstream from that larger point, which is that people have an innate sense that if you're 30 and 35 and 40 and 45, you're going to go through a big disruption in 5 or 10 or 15 years, and humans have never prepared for that before. So point one, I want to come back to these. I'm going to give you headlines here. Point one is we're living through a massively disruptive period, economically chiefly. Point two is there are all sorts of implications for the digital revolution on education and schooling. You know that, but it has both means and ends disruptions. The ends are lots and lots of people assume that the purpose of schooling is to get you prepared for that job, and you're going to pick that one job. You can now be done schooling. You can stop learning, supposedly, and now you're going to do this job for the rest of your life, and you're going to be able to earn your keep. You're going to be able to put bread on the table. You're going to have a meaningful way to serve your neighbor. That's an ends problem. We all believe, as Christians, one of my kids is named Augustine, for goodness sake, so we're going to talk about vocation some along the way today. We all believe we have lots of vocations, not just the one primary thing you get paid for, but since lots of our neighbors and the cultural stew in which we swim acts like our work is the thing that school is to prepare us for, if work is being radically transformed, inevitably schooling and higher education are going to be radically transformed. That's sort of an ends set of questions. The means set of questions, you all know well, that we're radically changing the way we deliver education. The modalities of education are changing very, very rapidly. So my second point is the digital revolution has lots of implications for how we think about education and schooling. Third point, by the way, though this is scary, and I'm going to talk about how scary it is to a lot of our neighbors, I'm going to talk about declining life expectancy, arguably for the first time in U.S. history. It's happening right now. That's weird. There's lots that's big and scary about the disruptive moment in which we live. I think you all and the movement that you lead have lots and lots of great opportunities because of this disruption. There's a lot that we can be pessimistic about that's happening culturally and economically in our country. We're not here to talk about politics today. You're welcome. But there's a lot we could be depressed about American civic culture as well. But I think the digital revolution, for those of us who believe in, is your theme today from or this conference from Isaiah 40? Is it about permanent things, did I hear? For those of us who believe that education should be about orienting us to the God who speaks, who seeks and saves, who created us and called it good, who comes and was incarnate to redeem us and is going to ultimately redeem all of this all around us, we believe in big, long-term things. There are a lot of times where the veil of tears feels like it's really, really long, but eschatologically, we have hope. We believe in big things that we want to orient our kids to. And so it turns out when lots of the schooling around us is ridiculously faddish and short-term, faddish with a D, not a T, I meant to say. The German in my soul doesn't distinguish those letters much. We're happy to see the disintermediation of a lot of things that people thought were eternal but that weren't eternal. The disruption of a lot of schooling that wasn't very good for kids, that pretended they were cogs in a machine rather than flowers in a garden. We're glad to see that system unsettled. So my third point is, let's be optimistic about some of the opportunities around us. And the fourth, and where I really won't do much, but I'll just give you a few headlines to help transition us to question and answer, we ought to think about the new institutions, the new coalitions, the new visions, and the new habits that the digital age is going to require. Because I think we are transitioning in some ways back toward more semi-nomadic lives. There has never been a time in human history where as people got richer, they didn't have more stuff, or to state it without a double negative. Throughout all of human history, every time people got richer, the rich people got more and more stuff. Are you like me? Do you feel weighed down by the size of your closet in your garage? I don't want all that stuff. And it turns out the Uberization of everything is probably going to create a moment over the next decade or two where wealthier people, and by that I mean you all, I mean middle-class Americans, the richest people in all of human history, people are probably going to have markedly less stuff 20 years from now than we have today because we're going to rent a lot more. You think about ride-sharing as a shorthand version of what Uber is, that's a front end of this wave. How many of you own one or two drills in your garage, but that don't actually work when you need them? I submit the vast majority of you, unless you're a really good craftsman, 15 or 20 years from now, you're not going to own a drill. It's going to be delivered by drone to the port at your mailbox 45 minutes before you need to use it. It's going to be a way better drill than the one you have now. It's going to work instantly, and you're going to rent it for $2 a year instead of owning it for $180 and then having to throw it away because you haven't used it for 2 years. The battery went dead because you didn't ever recharge it. As we transition back to a slightly more semi-nomadic lifestyle, thinking big thoughts about what we want to be orienting our kids toward is a really big challenge, but it's also a great calling. It's a really interesting time to live, trying to think about what will it look like when our kids have access to essentially everything that's ever been written in an instant. It turns out an editing function, filtering, emotional intelligence, rhetorical or communication skills are going to matter more than they've ever mattered before in a world of AI, where almost all the material stuff we're going to need is going to be produced a lot cheaper and a lot more easily accessible in shared ways in your community. So big four. Massively disruptive moment. Huge implications for the digital revolution on the educational era in which we live. Lots of upside opportunities for those of us who are skeptical of John Dewey. May his ideas die soon. And number four, as we transition to question and answer, what does that mean for us in terms of the institutions we should be building to live a life of gratitude to our God and loving our neighbor and thinking about what kind of stuff we want in our neighborhood? Not just institutions, but also habits, also coalitions. The coalition, by coalition, I mean there have been a bunch of us who, for theological, anthropological reasons, never liked John Dewey. Or because of he hated the family, we didn't like John Dewey. It turns out lots of our neighbors who may not share our theology are also going to become increasingly skeptical of John Dewey because what he was doing was fundamentally schooling for the factory age. He was creating humans that were creative, built by our God, created by our God with massive dignity. He was reducing them to cogs on an assembly line. And lots of our neighbors are going to increasingly have eyes to see at a common grace level, eyes to see that that's an insufficient way to recognize people who are created imago Dei. That's my big four. So let me start with the end of lifelong work, or let me at least start with the headline of the end of lifelong work, but get to it through the cultural, I think they're kind of canaries in a coal mine, about how disruptive this moment is and how much it's scaring our neighbors. We are living at a time where we have seen three consecutive years of declining life expectancy in America. We've only had decent mortality data for about 80 years, but most epidemiologists and demographers and public health folks who do medical history believe the last time there was a three-year decline in life expectancy, it was 1916, 1917, 1918, exactly 100 years before our current one. 2016, 2017, 2018, there was a massive flu epidemic combined with World War I. Life expectancy declined those 3 years. We haven't had anything like that since. We live in a world where 10 years ago, there was no one who predicted declining life expectancy in the U.S. If you go to Silicon Valley, I used to do some private equity and hedge fund work, there are lots of people in Silicon Valley who believe we're 20 or 30 years out from a moment where life expectancy will, for a time, grow more than a year per year. Meaning they believe that a lot of the research we're doing on miniaturization technologies are going to lead to implantable supercomputers, that we're going to get injections, and you're going to have computers swimming around in your bloodstream repairing your cancer before you've gotten your cancer diagnosis. Our shared life expectancy in this room is 81. My 8-year-old son, who was born in Douglas County, which is Omaha, Nebraska, 8 years ago, according to CDC tables, he has a 50-50 statistical chance of seeing age 100. All this is another way of saying all of our medical research is extending life. No other industrialized nation has declining life expectancy. Infant mortality is down. 80-year-old longevity is up. 85-year-old longevity is up. The two biggest killers in America are cancer and heart disease. They both kill right around a quarter of all the people that will die this year in the U.S. So of everyone who will die in the United States in 2019, half of them will die of cancer and heart disease. Everything else adds up to the other half. COPD and stroke are both 5.5% killers. Those big two, massively declining death rates from cancer and heart disease. So how can this be? We've got an equation in front of us, and our life expectancy went down in 2016, down in 2017, down in 2018, and yet every normal indicator of how you get to the math of life expectancy says life is getting longer. How do we have declining life expectancy? 25 to 45-year-olds are killing themselves in a massive epidemic in our country, and we don't even know it's happening. There are four curves that are spiking off the charts: opioids, suicide proper, other forms of overdose, and liver disease. Liver disease, opioids, overdose, and suicide are spiking in 25 to 45-year-old population. What's going on? We have an epidemic of loneliness. There has been a halving of friendship in America since I graduated high school. I'm 47. I graduated high school in 1990. Average American had 3.2 statistical friends. Today, the average American has 1.8 friends. I heard chuckling about statistical friends. Let me define it as Aristotelian friends. In a room like this, I can get away with going straight Aristotle. What's a friend? It's somebody you love. It's when you have an expansive sense of the self. One of the best ways to think about friendship is not all the peer element to being a friend, because there's an equity in a friendship, but just think about basic love where you're no longer making a choice. Think about how you feel about your kids. When my 8-year-old is flying down the street on his bike, I don't choose to have my chest expand and my like cheekbones feel like they're welling up with tears. He's happy and I'm happy. I didn't choose it. I just love him. When my 15 and 17-year-old daughters have a mean girl experience at school and they're hurt, I ache. I don't choose to ache. I have a friend who says, you can never be happier than the saddest of your children at any given moment. So the more those of you who have 7 kids, like, you're setting your denominator really low. That's what a friend is, right? We don't, in our culture, we don't even know how to think about friendship. Friendship is not Senate friends. My good friend, the senator from Vermont, whose face I'm about to tear off in a debate. Friendship is not Facebook friends, like the dopamine hit of a feedback loop of liking something, right? Like, and by the way, statistically, you go from 50 to 100 or 100 to 200 social media friends, the people are slightly happier, because it probably means that you know people, right? If you have 50 Facebook friends, it probably means you don't have a lot of actual relationships in your life, and so there's an indicator there. But you go from 200 to 500 Facebook friends, you go from 500 to 1,000 Facebook friends, this has been studied now by sociologists, you don't get any happier. You go from 1,000 to 5,000 Facebook friends, you get significantly less happy. Why? People who spend lots and lots of time on social media grooming their online identity are using it for things that are supplanting rather than supplementing known human relationships. There are lots of ways social media can be used for good. I have an accountability group on WhatsApp. I also serve some of my oldest friends in real life, and we stay together on WhatsApp. I'm also on the Intelligence Committee in the Senate, and I now know that WhatsApp is completely unreliable because of how many nation states have hacked it. So our accountability group will soon be moving to Signal, but whatever. WhatsApp is really valuable in our life because these are guys who get together sometimes once every 3 or 6 months, but sometimes it takes 2 years. And when you get back together, and we've invested so much of our life together from 18 to 23, 24, 25, when we get back together, if there's a bump in one of my buddies' marriages, or if there's some problem that one of his kids is having, if you get together and you haven't been together for 6 months to 2 years, you don't click right back together the same way you do when we're engaging in a social media context on almost daily basis. Social media can be used for good when it's supplemental to actually incarnate relationships. When it's supplanting them, it's disastrous. And so the people who are between 1,000 and 5,000 Facebook friends, by and large, of course there are exceptions, some of you are leading institutions and you're fundraising or you're building something important or you're recruiting new students to your schools, so this is not a hard and fast rule, but by and large, if you're between 1,000 and 5,000 Facebook friends, you don't know the person who lives 2 doors away from you, and there is a statistical correlate to happiness that is about knowing the person who lives 2 doors away from you in your neighborhood. And if you don't know them, you're less likely to be happy. And if you have 5,000 Facebook friends, you're less likely to know them. There's a collapse of friendship in our time, and one of the reasons that's happening is because we're rich. Because we don't have necessity that forces us to need each other. We don't borrow sugar from the lady next door. We have infinite amounts of sugar in our pantry. We have the freedom from necessity that actually removes the opportunity to be needed. And to love your neighbor by letting them know that you need them. But one of the other reasons that friendship is in collapse and thick community is in collapse is because jobs are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Again, this is a feedback loop around being really smart. It is great that humans are smart enough that we can figure out how to automate tasks and disrupt the most repetitive, redundant, non-intellectually valued pieces of a job. It's great that we're good at automation, except it has one of these side effects, which means that a lot of men who are 25 or 30 or 35 and 40 and not great communicators, it turns out they're not gonna work on the line next to the same guy for their whole life. And most men build no new friendships after age 25. Average duration at a firm in the 1970s when I was growing up was 26 years for a primary breadwinner. Average duration at a job today is 4.2 years and getting shorter. What does that mean? It means if you're a guy who struggles at, you know, emotional transparency with your friends, you used to be able to still build up relationship by age 36 and 38 with the grunts that you would make at work to the guy next to you that meant, hey, we almost got enough money saved to buy that cabin up at the lake we've wanted since we first got married. Or my kid's having this problem. It takes a lot of long time for a lot of guys to get any good at talking to other guys. By the way, I'm not going to do a ton of neurobiology here, but we live at a strange, strange moment when our culture is telling us that there are 57 genders and there's no connection between gender and biology at exactly the same moment that science has never had more clarity about the difference between male and female brains. There has never been more clarity. If you know Moore's Law, the sort of popular conception of Moore's Law is usually every 24 months I can buy a laptop that's twice as fast for half the price at Best Buy, right? It's just an exponential way to think about consumerism or computing power in the personal tech space, right? But Moore's Law has much broader uses and applicability than that. And neurology is going through a Moore's Law spiking exponential curve right now. We have learned more about the human brain in general and the frontal lobe, which controls executive function. We've learned more about the frontal lobe in the last 19 months than the beginning of human history until 19 months ago. So if you're interested in neurology and you have a textbook that's more than 3 or 4 years old, throw it away. Don't give it to Goodwill. You're hurting your neighbor. What we're finding out is it turns out men have far more connections front to rear on the same side of each side of the brain, and women have far more cross-hemispheric connections. And so the stereotype of these two, it's not true of every individual. Please, if somebody's recording this, I want to introduce caveats into every sentence, lest the soundbite is taken out of context. But ostensibly, the front to rear connections enable intense long-term focus. And the cross-hemispheric connections enable more navigation of disruption and complexity. Guess what, fellas? You got crappier brains. Because it turns out almost everything that's going to matter more in the future is the ability to navigate disruption and complexity, and women's brains have a lot more of the connections that are going to matter more. One of the reasons this matters is because men atrophy relationships and women tend to be good at still building relationships in middle age and later years. If you survey 60-year-old Americans by gender about who their best friend is, 60% of 60-year-old men define their wife as their best friend. 29% of women define their husband as their best friend. Why? Is it because the husbands are just so much better at cherishing? No, they have fewer options. Ladies, he's paying more attention to you at 60 than at 50 because he had a falling out with that one guy, and that was 50% of his alternate pool. So we live at a time where lots and lots and lots of people are lonely in general. And in addition to being lonely in general, we are having a time of collapsing nuclear families. We have an epidemic of fatherlessness among us. I'm the third most conservative guy in the Senate by voting record, but I sit in Daniel Patrick Moynihan's desk on purpose, liberal senator from New York State, who left a few years before I got there. Moynihan is the author of a whole bunch of really important things, including the quote, everybody's entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. It's attributed to a lot of people, but it's actually a Moynihan line. Moynihan is also the guy who wrote the report on the crisis of the black family in 1965. And at that point, what Moynihan identified was out-of-wedlock birth rates in America writ large were 6%, and in the black community, they were between 22 and 25%, depending on which survey you used. And he said, this won't work. America works. America, as a constitutional structure, believes in freedom from government, not because you want to live isolated, autonomous, individual lives where you have no social capital and no thick community, but we don't want the state to frame all that stuff by coercion because we want people to frame their meaningful relationships by voluntarism and persuasion and neighborliness and love. And he said, freedom from is what life is about. We want government to have freedom to protect us from certain bad things that could happen so that then we can go worship freely and try to persuade our neighbors and build a community and try to woo someone to marry you and to build a better mousetrap or a better app. But Freedom 2 only works if our kids are healthily launched. And he said, if 25% of one of our communities are growing up fatherless, America won't work. America will collapse if that happens. Today, out-of-wedlock birth rates in America are 40% in the culture as a whole without regard to race. It was 6 in 1965, but nearly 25% black. It's now 40% in the culture writ large, but it's much worse than that because the curve is declining so rapidly that there are a whole bunch of 38-year-old women having their fourth kid in a stable marriage, and there are a whole bunch more 25-year-olds having their first kid. And so what you find is if you disaggregate by the age of mom, 59% of babies born to moms under 30 now have no meaningful connection to the baby's father. 59% of babies born to women under 30 in America. There's all sorts of reasons, really important cultural arguments and debates. We live in a time when our economic and most mobile elites are doing something that Brad Wilcox, a very thoughtful sociologist at the University of Virginia and a friend of Keith Nix's, defines as talking left, walking right. The upper one-third of America pays rhetorical claims to the family that it doesn't matter at all. Free everybody from all these old traditionalist constraints. So they talk left, and yet they walk farther right than at any point since the early 1970s. The rise of no-fault divorce and an epidemic of marital infidelity in the late 1960s gave way by the late 1970s, and wealthier people realized that didn't work very well. And so right now, the actual lived mores of the upper 30% of America are far more conservative than at any point since the mid to late 1970s. Talking left, walking right. And yet, we don't have any shared culture about what this means. So it means not just the poorest folks, but middle-class people are being sent all these signals in our culture that says family structure doesn't matter, commitment doesn't matter, kids don't need that. They'll be fine. They'll thrive as long as somebody loves them. It doesn't matter whether or not the kid has any certainty that the same person will love them in 24 months. It's hogwash. So ideas matter, but one of the fundamental things that's happening in our time is the transformation of work is meaning that a whole bunch of middle-aged men don't know what their identity is. Because they used to believe if they kept their nose clean and they finished high school and they were willing to work 40 hours a week at the factory, they'd be able to provide for their family forever. Brawn over brains. There are never going to be those jobs that are going to be stable for families again. That doesn't mean everybody needs college, by the way. That's not my point. But the idea that you won't have to learn how to learn and relearn again when you're 35 and 40 and 45 and 50, it's just going to be required of everybody. And we haven't told ourselves the truth about that. And so it turns out adolescence, which was a massive disruption with the rise of industrialization 150 years ago, but just for teens, we talk about adolescence like it's mostly about puberty. Adolescence is mostly not about your body going from a childlike body to an adult body. It's mostly about the identity crisis of the fact that we often say, what do you want to be? What we mean is, what are you going to do? Well, guess what? What are you going to do is not going to be one thing as a paid vocation that's going to define your identity anymore. Think how deeply ingrained this is in us as medieval to recently modern people. Coopers, Smiths, Bakers, these are last names. They're names that came from specialized callings, right? McKinsey & Company, a place I used to work, believes that by the end of 2022, this is 3 years from now, 50% of Americans will not have any one income source that arrives at 50% of their take-home pay. In Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which is obviously a rich ski resort community, so there's some people who live there, and there are some people who have a second or third home or vacation there, there's a phrase that people now use in colloquial conversation in Jackson. Is he a three-house or a three-job guy? Everybody's a three-house or a three-job guy or gal. Three jobs are the Uberization of the economy, where you're going to cobble together a whole bunch of different things. By the way, I don't think this is all bad. I think there are good and bad things in it. I think there are a bunch of quite interesting things about it compared to turning the exact same bolt on an assembly line from age 18 till age 65 when you got the golden watch. I think there are a bunch of great things about the three-job economy, but it's going to create a kind of uncertainty that we've not habituated and socialized ourselves to having to be prepared for. I'm going to stop there. This is my rhetorical failing because I told you I was going to do this. I'm going to transition hard and bumpy to a point about education because I'm committed to stopping this at 45 minutes so we can then spend time in Q&A after that. When we get to education, means and ends of education are being rapidly disrupted in our time. The ends point is obvious. The idea that everybody's going to go to college, that everybody used to go to secondary school, and then you could get a job, and then there are fewer of those jobs over time. The average number of people working in the big tool factory economies of the 1950s, the highest watermark ever was 31% of Americans worked in factories in 1956. Today, it's 7% of Americans work in factories or big tool economy jobs. We have far more output now than we had in the 1950s, which is another way of saying most of the debates, again, I promise I'm not trying to get near politics, but I'm the most pro-free trade senator. So I want to just acknowledge to you, there's a whole bunch of stuff we do in our politics that we blame on trade and immigration that are 90% about automation. So the industrial economy is declining not because there used to be a 38,000-person factory in Youngstown, and today that same company has a branded factory that may be outside Mexico City, and they took the factory from Youngstown to Mexico City. That may be part of the debate, and we can have big policy debates where we might not all agree, but the important point, the statistically significant point for your neighbors, is that the factory had 38,000 people in Youngstown in 1970, and today it has 707 people, whether it's in Mexico City or it's in Youngstown. And the speed with which we disintermediate work is going to get faster and faster and faster. Secondary education is going to have to change. Higher education right now mostly doesn't work for most people. We talk about the student loan crisis all the time as if it's about the fact that higher education is too expensive. Higher education is way too expensive. There's way too little quality for the money we spend. And yet, the more important fact about the student loan debt crisis is that the majority of student loan debt is held by people who never finished college. The supply side of higher education failed them. We led people into programs where one-third of kids fail out of college from fall of freshman to fall of sophomore year. We used to make an intentional choice at age 18. Are you going to higher education or are you going to the factory? Now we don't know what to do with kids, so we push them all into higher education. We just let them flunk out their freshman year. And it turns out there's this bizarre conspiracy between faculty members who mostly want to research, not teach, and freshmen who mostly want to party, not go to class. And it turns out the two of them have an agreement that works pretty well for both of them. Let's just do a lot less work in college. And so the Carnegie Hours system that has been in place since the GI Bill, which is basically the idea that the reason we say 12 hours or 15 hours of school is a full-time load is because we assume you're supposed to do 3 hours outside of class work for every hour in class. So 12 hours means you're really working 48. 15 hours means you're really working 60. This was true in the late 1940s. We don't have a lot of survey data about how it changed over time, but we know in 1990 it had declined from the late 1940s, but not very much. It wasn't statistically significant. Roughly, the Carnegie hours worked in 1990. In the year 2010, 2011, 2012, this massive longitudinal study at the University of Chicago was done of colleges and universities all over America. How many hours do you think the average American college student works either per week or, think about it, per hour outside of class for every hour inside of class? They work on average 8/10 of an hour outside of class for every hour in class. So that means the average college student in America that's going full-time, not the college students that are going to school part-time because they're working in addition, the average college student who's full-time is doing about 19 hours of work per week. The University of Chicago has shown that the vast majority of kids, this doesn't include those who drop out, those who fail out, one-third of kids flunk out between fall of freshman and fall of sophomore. The average kid from fall of freshman till their arrival at fall of junior year learns nothing. The median student learns nothing in their first 2 years of college. They learn quite a bit junior and senior year. They've learned how to navigate all of the disruptions of being on your own for the first time. But really what we're doing is a really poor coming-of-age, outward-bound program for college kids. That's really what most colleges and universities are doing. And so I think what comes next is massive disruption of the educational delivery system. Clayton Christensen, who's one of the best business school profs in America, he's a prof at Harvard Business School, and he does a whole bunch of very interesting work on the history of technology adoption. He believes 70% of higher education institutions in America go bankrupt within the next 10 years. And when he said it, it was so jaw-dropping, and this is like not a ranter, this is a very thoughtful human being. When he said it, a whole bunch of people on like CNBC or Fox News Business brought him on and said, defend this. You were kind of being hyperbolic, right? And he said, I'm not exactly sure if my model's right, but if you made me bet money Is it more likely that we hit the 70% bankruptcy mark in 9 years or in 11 years? I'd have to bet on 9 years. So he thinks what's going to happen is a huge disruption of technology for classroom delivery. And I want to be clear, I'm mixed on this. I think the revolution has the digital revolution has lots of benefits. I also think there are very real costs in contexts where it implicates worldview. When you're wrestling with theology, when you're wrestling with great literature, when you're teaching history, I'm a history professor, sorry, I guess I hadn't said that. The delivery moment implicates your worldview, so I think it's much, much harder to do that in a disembodied way. It turns out we've done longitudinal studies now on accounting classes. And so if you have three kinds of accounting, all online, all in person, or a hybrid model, it's pretty clear to us that the all online will be the cheapest, the hybrid will be the median priced, and the all in person will be the most expensive. And so most people then assume quality must be inversely related to cost, and so people assume that all in person is the best. It's not. The hybrid is by far the best way to learn accounting. Why would that be? The college that I used to be a president of, we had a pretty decent accounting, pretty large accounting program, and we used to brag when we were recruiting students, we had a 40-to-1 faculty to student ratio. The University of Nebraska-Lincoln, one of our competitors, had a 300-to-1 faculty to student ratio, and so we bragged about how great it was that a student would be in a 40-to-1 class experience. It turns out statistically it makes absolutely no difference in accounting, because there are five nerds out of 40 or five out of 300 who raise their hand all the time and talk all the time, and they're at the top end of the class, and they become the feedback loop for the professor, and he or she believes they understand where the class is because of the five kids who talk all the time. And so what you really want is you want high-frequency, low-stakes quizzing so you can constantly assess either the 40 or the 300 or 2 million in an online class, and if you regularly figure out what the bottlenecks are in your class, then you need to deliver a human to help you wrestle through the place where you were stuck at a bottleneck. Higher education doesn't have any idea what's coming. Stock brokerage, travel agency, music publishing, book publishing, you can think of industry after industry that we've seen disintermediation of the middle of the channel, sometimes to great benefit. No offense to the stockbrokers in the room, because obviously some of you provide lots of knowledge and information. But there was a time when people knew what transaction they wanted, and they just had to wait on the phone with you for 2 hours to pay you $175 because you had access to the market. Now all of us can get instantaneous access to the market for $6.95 per transaction. That's a great revolution. In publishing, especially daily newspapers, the decline of the ability to know how to pay for editing, really painful. We don't have shared facts in America right now. I think the death of editing in our journalism and the decline of shared facts is really dangerous for the republic. So I'm mixed about the digital revolution, and I'm mixed about it when it comes to education as well. But this much is clear. All over America, you have colleges and universities that are still engaged in an arms race about how they can build bigger, shinier buildings. There are going to be lots fewer kids going to class on residential campuses in 5 and 10 and 15 years from now. And lots of these schools and their boards haven't started to reckon with the real problem they face, which is there's going to be a technological substitute for lots of the labor they deliver on their campus, and their prices are going to have to start going down. In most every sector of the economy, when things work better, you get higher quality and lower cost stuff at the same time. You know that's what you expect with your laptop. You expect that the laptop you paid $700 for a couple years ago, you ought to go into Best Buy or Walmart and today be able to buy it for $300. It better be a better machine than the old $700 one. That never happens in education. Why? Because we're delivering it on a model that's pre-Gutenberg, right? Oxford exists. Oxford exists as a corporate structure from the 1870s, but before that, today Oxford has like 38 colleges, but until 150 years ago, there were 24 colleges at Oxford. 12 of them had been around for more than 700 or 800 years. They were just a place where a whole bunch of scholars who owned books lived. And you could go and study with them, and you paid them room and board, and they stood up in front of the class and lectured, and you interlined because you didn't have a copy of the book. They read the book, you tried to make a copy of it, and then they lectured on what they had done, and you wrote in the marginalia what the professor thought about the book. You were coming up with a copy of the book. We're headed to a world where all of us, TED Talks is one way to do it, lots of great Christian websites are another way to do it, we're moving to a world where every great lecture that ever exists in America is ubiquitously accessible to all of us for free instantly. That's not quite on the order of the Gutenberg Press, but it's pretty darn similar. And the way it's going to disrupt higher education is going to rattle these people, and they don't know what's coming. And so I think when we see neighbors who are lonely and scared about the second adolescence that's coming as a mid-career, middle-age moment, and when we see lots of schools that are going to be challenged because of the Dewey model they've bought into implicitly without giving sufficient thought to the dignity of human anthropology. I don't mean the goofy academic discipline, university anthropology. I mean theological anthropology. John Calvin in Book 1.1 of the Institutes says it doesn't really matter whether you start with God or you start with man, because you can't contemplate the other without thinking of the first. You can't understand yourself as a sinner without understanding that there's a righteous law that's a straight line, and I can't measure up to it. And you can't start contemplating God without being shaken to the foundations of the fact that I can't approach this holy God. Woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips. And so theological anthropology says a whole bunch of things about our neighbor, and the institutions that most of our neighbors are having to send their kids to don't take seriously who they are. John Dewey did that on purpose. Rousseau and Augustine have been in a debate for hundreds of years. Augustine was right, but Rousseau's still interesting. There's a whole bunch about the Emile that every one of us ought to read. There's a whole bunch about the Emile that works, even though he's fundamentally flawed about the fact that sin comes from inside me, not from the things that are environmentally around me coming to me. There's a symbiotic relationship. I'm so sinful, and the people I'm living with are so sinful, especially Melissa, that we end up in a... That was supposed to be funnier than that. I'll do penance later. The social structures are, of course, fallen and sinful, but the origins of sin are in our endemic nature. Rousseau's wrong about that, but it turns out by common grace, he's still right about lots and lots and lots of stuff about how to parent with the grain with your kids. All of us who've lived, you know, more, if you've got a kid who's a teenager or beyond, and you got a couple of kids who are behind them, if your first kid was working out really great, you became convinced that it was your theory that made it work, right? And then all of a sudden you have a second kid and you do the exact same thing and it has these completely different consequences. Rousseau has a lot to teach us about how to think about parenting with the grain. Rousseau's wrong about theology. He's wrong about anthropology. He's wrong about sin. And yet, Augustine and Rousseau, really interesting debate. Dewey, not really worth reading. Because what Dewey does is he says, oh, shut up with all that abstract stuff. I know how to run things now to prepare the kid through this factory to get to the place where he or she needs to come out. And the biggest problem I have is the parents. They love their kids in such an intimate, deep way that they're attending to all of their needs. Let me, Dewey, run it as a factory. That's the environment in which we live. That environment is going to collapse. That environment is going to be disrupted. Right now, 41 of 50 governors in the country have a P16 initiative. Instead of the old K-12 bureaucracy, 41 of our 50 states have said, let's start thinking about early childhood and early literacy, really important stuff we should talk about there. The reality is, if you got 20 kids who arrive at the first day of kindergarten, and half of them can read or almost read, and half of them can't at all, you look statistically at where they are at age 18, the 10 that arrived able to read are still the top 10, and the 10 that arrived not able to read didn't move very much. There's lots wrong, and we should have debates about how you love our neighbor in that PK space. So I'm not that worried about those debates. I'm worried about the institutionalized assumptions that you need to pull a kid from a family earlier. But there's meaningful debate there. Grade 16, a disastrous concept. Trying to go from K-12 to P16 as if college is grade 13, 14, 15, and 16. The most fundamental way to think about the flip that happens between secondary and higher education is you go from a model where there's a sage on the stage and the students are passively receiving most of the information to you get to college and the students should be believing that they've been turned loose in a storehouse, a cornucopia of good stuff, books and debates and professors. But the students need to go rattle that tree and shake it to the ground. And oh, by the way, it's not just grade 13 kids or freshmen. It should be climbing down to grade 12, grade 11, grade 10. What we should want in the world is not the transition that we're failing at societally between high school and college to be we shouldn't want the answer to be make college more like high school. We should want to make high school more like college. We should want to do more assessment of what kids are learning or whether they're learning in higher ed, and we should see it climb down. I think there's a lot about the disruptive moment we're entering that is hugely opportunity filled for all of us, but only if we figure out how to embrace it in a way that makes us winsome. Obviously, we do saving grace evangelism as well, but at a pedagogical model level, winsome common grace evangelism to try to go and win people to a model that you all are celebrating and building that is going to allow for new institutions that is persuasive rather than scary to our neighbors. And so I want to close by saying thank you. Thank you for the things you invest in. Melissa and I have a complicated life that we live 4 months of the year in DC and 8 months of the year in Nebraska, and Dad flies away four nights every week. I take a kid with me a lot. I'm the only commuting dad in the US Senate in the sense that I tug a kid with me. Usually if you're the only one doing something, it means you're a fool. But we do it because I don't want to miss their upbringing. And a lot of what we've been able to do with hybridized and classical schooling is because of stuff we've learned from many of you, even though we've never met you before. So thank you for the way you've loved us, and go forth and love your neighbor more. We got big, big, big new institutions to build amid this digital disruption. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll go sit down over here.
Where'd that water go?
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Got a few questions for you. Some may be appropriate, some may not.
Start with the inappropriate.
Are you going to run in 2024 for president?
No. Noxious okay. Weed Control Board of Dodge County is my future.
And a really interesting, how well do you think the Huskers are going to do this year?
Can we have an extra hour? Vegas has our over-under at 7.5 wins. Bet on the Huskers.
Awesome. 7.5. It's good.
We're going to win more than 7.5.
I need to clear the
7.75.
I need to clear the air a little bit. My feet were not up on the table. I have video evidence. The chair was broken.
Have y'all heard about deep fakes technology? Keith can manufacture a video to change history.
Do you believe the federal government should maintain the education department? Does the digital age mean the U.S. government must stop making education directives because of the variety of educational modalities?
Yeah, I mean, so just at a fundamental level, if you think as a constitutional nerd about what the federal government exists to do, it is not to educate kids under age 18. So I'm not a fan of the Department of Education. And yet, as a political reality, it's not going away. So then what should we be using it for? I think two things. One, there's all sorts of assessment stuff that could be more broadly disseminated if our states functioned as 50 laboratories of democracy, as the founders envisioned. What I'd like to see the Department of Education doing, because, again, as a constitutional purist, I wish the institution didn't exist, but since that's not a political reality at present, I'd like to see the Department of Education view itself as a massive data dissemination project, not somebody that's trying to mandate anything about how any state educates their kids. The second thing we need to do is recognize that we have a Sputnik moment among us right now, and we are not noticing the wake-up call. In a lot of ways, the long-term tech race that we're entering with China is scarier to me than 1958-59 was in the Sputnik moment. And the future of AI technologies, machine learning, biotech, quantum computing, we are in a long-term, very dangerous battle with China. And the amount of national focus they're putting around math and science, and the fact that we mostly do math and science as feel-good stuff, like let's do self-esteem about whether or not a kid thinks they did well. Our 18-year-olds and our 22-year-olds and our graduate students just can't compete with the Chinese nationals that are in American undergrad and graduate institutions right now. So I think one thing the Department of Education could do that'd be really useful is to just be sounding huge alarm bells about how bad math and science is in America today.
Yep. What do you think about the future of the non-college educated student, the trades? Our students pursuing trades, fields that are not college necessary,
Yeah, we need to come up with a model that's parallel to but different than the four-year accreditation barrier to entry traditional 18 to 22-year-old degree. We need credits and competencies that are portable and stackable. I think you're going to see entrance into this marketplace that are people you wouldn't expect. I think colleges and universities are not very innovative right now. I think Walmart is going to be incredibly innovative. One of the things Walmart is thinking about doing is shrinking the part of the store that you have access to by 30%+ right now. So your Walmart might be only 70% as much square footage that you would get to, and that will shrink over time. It will get smaller and smaller, yet there'll be far more product. How could that be? It'd be because you won't have any of the storehouses happening out there. There'll be a small number of things that you'll put in your cart as you walk through the store, but mostly you're going to end up wandering through like a Hema Market. For anybody who's been in China, it's sort of a Whole Foods equivalent called Hema. And you walk through and you just wand everything you want, and there's all the stuff moving around on the ceiling. And when you get to the register to check out, in China it's done by facial recognition technology, so it's even scarier, but you just put your face up against a screen and the stuff falls out of the sky and it's your bags to exit the store. You didn't carry it through the store with you in a cart. Everything you wanted is delivered by robots behind the store and from above and through. And so Walmart knows that their human capital needs at a 12, I think Walmart's just in the process of raising their minimum wage a buck or two, at a 12 or 13 or $14 level, their needs are going to go down, and yet their people who have math and science skills and robotic skills are going to go way up, and so they're going to lose some people by attrition, but they also just want to train their people through because they already know who they think has good customer service skills. And so I think you're going to see portable, stackable credentialing, but I don't know who the validator of that's going to be, but some new institution will rise up, I think, to validate that in a way that it'll be similar to but different than regional accreditation in higher ed.
The next question's a bit of a personal one, not my personal question, but it probably appeals to your college or university president experience. So someone in the audience says this: I'm coming late to classical education professionally, and we're transferring our son, currently in 10th grade, to a small classical school. He's worried it will hurt his college and career chances. What would you say to him?
She framed it, or he framed it, as a personal question, and so there are all sorts of variables in there, right? So I don't think the right answer is to just say 100% don't worry about the credentialing piece. I think the right answer is to say 90% don't worry about the credentialing piece. So the overwhelmingly more important variable is, are you good at learning? And are you good at getting better at learning how to learn? Because that's what the future of the economy, and by that I mean love of neighbor, is going to require. If you're going to provide for your family, and if you're going to do something meaningful, if you're going to do something that's needed, something that benefits somebody. By the way, I didn't say this in my talk, but I want to just say it as a little bit of common grammar for us to have. Statistically, the number one correlate to happiness in life, we all believe theologically there are more important things than happiness, but the number one correlate to happiness in American life today, there's a subfield of sociology the last 15 years which is studying human happiness. The number one correlate is, on Monday morning when I leave home, do I think anybody needs me? Number one correlate. Do I have a job that I think matters? Not do I make a lot of money at it, not does my back hurt at the end of the day, and not do I have annoying coworkers, but do I think I'm needed? And so if you want to be needed in a world where automation is going to disrupt most jobs out of existence, you got to get good at learning how to learn. That's far more important than what college you go to. Now, in addition, there are network effects about what you do from age 18 to 22, so we shouldn't minimize that as if it's irrelevant, but I think it's a secondary consideration.
Yep. One last question up here, and then we might have time for one from the floor. I think you hit on this a little bit, but is the concept of adolescence a failed 20th century model? And if so, how will it impact education? You talked about a second adolescent. So, is that concept of adolescence a failed model?
This is one of my hobby horses, and so I feel like Keith put me on the spot by saying if we're going to go to the audience for a question or two, I can't go long, so I won't. But I'll give a commercial. Adolescence is, I think, a very good thing. Perpetual adolescence is a demonic thing. Perpetual adolescence is what's happening among us when we can't tell 15, 20, 25, and 30-year-olds apart. That's terrible. Adolescence is the greenhouse space that a lot of wealthy cultures for 2,500 years and almost all mass industrial cultures for about 150 years have allowed our kids post-puberty. I think it's a great thing to be able to say to kids, hey, just because your body went from pre-puberty to adult body doesn't mean you have to be finished in every way. You don't have to pretend your brain is done because it's not. The neurobiology is telling us right now that women's brains are not done until at least 5 or 6 years after puberty. Male brains are arguably never done, but they're they're definitely not done by the late 20s right now. Like, we're finding that the male brain and the feedback loops that form our brain, and by the way, this is important for those of us who want to say permanent things and quote Isaiah about our curricular preferences and things that we really believe align better with anthropology, we still need to be humble as well, because it isn't that everything that we think is permanent because it was used 1,500 or 2,000 years ago is inevitably better than everything we're going to learn next year. One of the things we're learning is that the old debate we used to have between nature and nurture, it's way too simple. Because what we used to pretend was nature is all your genetic innate stuff, and so supposedly that was done at birth, and nurture is all the environmental stuff we do to you or that you grow through. It turns out that's not the right way to think about it, because your nature isn't done for a really, really long time, and your brain is shaped by your environment. Digital addictions are really dangerous. The way we're bathing teenage brains in porn is really, really dangerous. And it is changing the brain. So given that we know that, given that we know that there's that much change, it is a good thing to have this idea of adolescence that says, don't take puberty as an indicator that our kids should quit school, work full-time, get married, have kids. They're not ready to be adults yet just because they went through puberty. Adolescence is that greenhouse protected space beyond puberty where we say, you're in a transition stage, it'll take a little while, but we have a destination for you. And you should care to share with us in buying into that destination. Perpetual adolescence is Peter Pan. It's a really, really bad idea. Adolescence is a pretty great thing. I think what's happening now, though, is we're creating midlife and quarter-life crises that are going to mirror adolescence. And some of that is where you're seeing a lot of these addictions and suicides happening as people realize, oh, if I'm disrupted at 30 or 35 and I don't have a lot of people around me, I'm not living in a household where mom and dad love me and help me get through the chaos of being an idiot when I'm 15. Think how many of our kids can do something crazy when they're 15 or 16, and their emotions spike, and you think they're never gonna stop bawling and screaming and wailing. 2 days later, they're over that problem, and 6 months later, the habit's gone. Why did that happen? Partly because they're changing really fast, but partly because they had you. They had a protected environment. They had shoulder on the road, right? Think about the difference between driving down a mountain in Colorado with no guardrail or a guardrail, or with no shoulder or a shoulder. Lots of us have gone over that rumble strip. If that was the edge of the mountain, we'd all be dead every time we hit the rumble strip. Parenting is partly about creating that shoulder. If we have a secondary adolescence at age 30 or 35 or 40, who's going to be our community? Who's going to be our neighborhood? Who's going to be the social capital when mom and dad aren't there to do that? We've got big disruption coming, and it means the adolescence that you're helping navigate kids through right now is far more important than we've ever understood before.
Very good. Ben, we have a car that we got to catch in about 5 minutes, so we're not getting to that last question, but we want to thank you for being with
us. Thanks, brother.
Yep.
Good to be with you all. Thanks, David.